3. Justicar Captain Pyvik sipped his morning kava, which always made him think about the woman he loved, and then sighed and pushed himself up from his desk.
"Something keeping you from the cabinet meeting, sir?"
Justicar Durenki asked, poking his head around the corner of Pyvik's door. Durenki was a freckled man who seemed to think that he could be in charge if he said everything like a question and smiled a lot. Once, Pyvik would have found that politically-minded avarice off-putting. After seeing the man take a knife to the gut in defense of the Republic, however, Pyvik had been forced to accept, begrudgingly, that Durenki was a very good Justicar, his desire for Pyvik's job notwithstanding, and so he gave Durenki a comfortable smile and said,
"I was deeply concerned about you not having asked me about it yet, Justicar."
"Just a reminder that I'd be happy to attend these meetings if you are too busy with other matters, sir."
"Tomlin,"
Pyvik called, as he walked past Durenki into the main office.
"Durenki said it again. Everyone has to take a drink."
"Right, sir."
The big man squinted, pinning a thumbtack to a map on the wall.
"I expect a report about the fairy creature disappearances when I get back," Pyvik added, with a look at both Tomlin and Durenki. "Something's going on, and even if that something is in the woods, it could spill into the villages next week, and then the towns, and then I'll be busy enough that Durenki has to go to my cabinet meetings."
"Wouldn't want that, sir,"
Durenki tossed back, and Pyvik grinned and headed off to the Archvoyant's palace. The floating city of Heavenspire was quieter now than it had been a few months back. Businesses were open again, and the damage had been repaired. But the people who lived up in the sky had learned in no uncertain terms that night that their city was a weapon, and that weapons sometimes got sent into battle. The airborne metropolis had never been friendly for families. A floating city, by its very nature, restricted the amount of sprawl required to add new residential areas, and as the capital of the Republic, it catered to wealthy cosmopolitan tastes. And in the wake of Heavenspire's near destruction, the city was almost entirely devoid of children. Pyvik wondered how many schools had closed. There were more flags hanging from the doorways, though, and that was something. The guards at the Archvoyant's palace knew Pyvik on sight, and after a quick and perfunctory check with a glamour ward, he was allowed inside. He made his way through the gardens and into the palace, where the Archvoyant steward directed him to the meeting already in progress, in what Pyvik remembered as the breakfast room.
"Captain Pyvik,"
Archvoyant Savart said as Pyvik came in.
"Didn't quite dodge this one, I see. My apologies, sir."
Pyvik ducked his head to the dark-skinned man in the Archvoyant's robes and to the other members of Savart's cabinet.
"Caught up in a case."
Savart raised an eyebrow.
"There's a fresh pot of case on the table. Pour yourself a cup and join us. We're going to shove a few more schools into this Republic, and you're going to use those Justicar skills to help me find the money for it."
Pyvik sighed and settled in with the other men and women at the large table. The room itself was lovely, open to the fresh air on one wall with a beautiful view of the morning sun, and the kava was significantly better than it was at the Justicar station. The other men and women were experts in their own field, merchants and bankers and guildsmen, and all of them were at least as busy as Pyvik was. It was several hours of work that Pyvik would rather have spent tracking down the enemies of the Republic, but on some level it was also like solving a puzzle, and while Pyvik didn't understand how all the money moved, he had a good eye and could point out things the guildsmen occasionally missed. The servants brought more kava and expensive pastries, and around midday, Servert sat back, stretched his lower back until something cracked audibly, and gave a long, wincing sigh.
"Ladies, gentlemen, I believe we have something to take to the Voyancy."
"Learned aren't going to like cutting the flame cannon upgrades on the port city walls," Lady Heflin said, shaking her head.
"And in the days when Archvoyant Silliston could stroll into the Voyancy chambers in his colonel's uniform and nobody could say no, that would carry more weight."
Savert smiled.
"Today, though, I have generals who will argue that fortifying the walls is just waiting for an attack, and the airship I'm throwing their way will be sweet enough to cover the taste of approving a few damned useless schools. Thank you, all."
"I'd watch out for the road concerns," Heflin added. Apparently roads off in the outer provinces are falling right into the earth.
Pyvik blinked.
Really?
Some old tower near the Westdyke estate collapsed.
Heflin shook her head.
Traders passing by said it looked like there'd been old crystals down in a cavern. Must have caved in.
She knocked on the table.
Here's hoping the rest of the ancient's crystal marvels stay functional.
God's willing, Savert said with a small smile.
The cabinet members filed out, and Savert gestured for Pyvik to stay after they had gone. When they were alone, Savert looked over across the table, his face unreadable.
How are you doing, Pyvik?
Pyvik nodded at the question.
As well as can be expected, sir. I miss her, you know, Savert said.
Pyvik forced a smile.
I didn't imagine you wouldn't, sir. Locke was her father's daughter. If she was still alive, she'd have been at this table this morning, helping children who can barely afford shoes get a decent education. Technically, if she were still alive, she'd be in an imperial prison, sir.
Savert chuckled.
Not the first time she'd broken the rules to do what she thought had to be done.
His smile faded.
I helped her enlist, you know.
Pyvik gathered the papers on the table up and wrapped them together to even out the edges.
She never told me that. Her father was furious with me. It was weeks before he'd even speak to me, Savert said,
toying with the ring of office he wore on one thumb.
Even he saw the truth eventually, though. Sir, she was going to join no matter what he wanted. With my help, she got in as a scout, with enough people knowing she was a nobleman's daughter that they gave her a chance.
Savert's hands had locked together tightly enough to bleed the colour from the pads of his fingers, but his voice stayed mild as he added.
Not a perfect chance, mind you. A woman and an Urujar, so she was never going to be a general. But with my backing, even the oldest, whitest officers couldn't completely ignore her talent. As hard as they tried.
Pyvik, a former scout captain himself, added, and Savert laughed again.
I helped her then, and I helped her with her mad scheme to rob Archbuoyant Silliston against my better judgment. If she were alive, Savert added,
with no particular emphasis while taking the papers from Pyvik,
I'd probably be trying to help her now.
Pyvik stood.
If she were alive, I'm sure that would be a great comfort, Archbuoyant. Heflin wouldn't drop a road collapse in casual conversation unless it were going to blow up in my face sooner rather than later, Savert added. I hope it's not something we need to worry about, and if there's an investigation in the matter, I'll want to hear your perspective before making any hasty decisions. Carver for the road? No, thank you, sir,
Pyvik said, and left as quickly as was reasonably possible to grab the message crystal in his desk and find out what in Bin Kodar's hell Locke was doing. The airship was very fast and very smooth and very expensive. The dinner selection was quite good for airship food. Westyke slept well in a bed with sheets almost as fine as those at his estate. When he woke up, took in breakfast and Carver, and strolled out to look over the railing, he was surprised to find that they were in mining country.
Oh,
he said to Commander Mirak, who had evidently been watching by the rail all night. He did not have the axe, as far as Westyke could see.
I thought we'd be going somewhere with people.
Mirak said nothing, and Westyke looked out at the great red-striped canyon that cut across the land like a glancing blow from a god.
Sunrise Canyon, I believe. Yes, Mirak said. As I recall, that's where the forge got a fair number of the crystals to make hunters. Must have people in the mine. You should be cautious, Mirak said.
It had not looked over at him.
The agents of the ancients would have enslaved you.
Westyke smiled at the hunter's idea that he might have forgotten that fact, and wondered where the axe Arika Yurichi might be at that moment.
That was the moment I was more committed than ever to the cause of the ancients, Mirak. Do you know why?
No,
Mirak said.
This republic used to mean something, Mirak. The settlers from the Old Kingdom came here because their original home was stagnant, and this was their chance to prove their worth. Now the Republic is stagnant.
He shook his head.
We make treaties with the Empire instead of fighting them back. We keep throwing good coin at schools instead of letting the people who care get their own tutors. I expect Archvoyant Savert will be trying to strip even more power from the nobles, just so that no peasants' feelings get hurt by hearing me called my lord. We're so busy trying to be nice, Mirok, that we're hiding the truth.
He smiled, looking down at the canyon full of dirt and crystal and opportunity. Mirok didn't ask what Westyke meant, but that was all right.
Some people are just better than others. You believe that the weapons of the ancients will acknowledge your superiority, Mirok said.
It was not quite a question.
I don't intend to give them a choice, Westyke said, and laughed. I finally found people who expect nothing less than the best. I can only hope they're ready for me. Well said.
The voice came not from Mirok, but from the axe riding at Mirok's hip. It had been there all along, hidden beneath the fold of Mirok's cloak. Westyke wondered if the axe had hidden himself deliberately, and then decided that it didn't really matter.
We have little use for those who are afraid to be bold, Lord Westyke,
Arika Yurichi added.
And I look forward to seeing what you can do.
Then why are you sending me to manage affairs at a mine? Westyke asked.
The axe had just said that he wanted boldness, after all. Arika Yurichi laughed.
The mine manages itself quite well. The workers have an excellent safety record, and I can only imagine how much they would detest a lord coming in to tell them how to do their jobs.
Westyke thought for a moment.
The processing center. This is where raw crystal is prepared for shipping and separated into the different ores that can hold various enchantments. This is the most magically rich spot in the Republic, Arika Yurichi said. Do you know why it is called the Sunrise Canyon? The red stripes on the walls, I had assumed, Westyke said. The paintings show them lighting up quite nicely when the sun hits them. And that probably isn't the actual reason. Not too long ago, the Champion of Dawn defeated the Champion of Dusk, Arika Yurichi said, as the airship began to descend into the canyon. In doing so, he fulfilled his part of the prophecy, ensuring that this world would move into day and not the terrible, endless night of the Glimmering Folk.
The airship sank past the bright red stone of the canyons.
And every dawn, Arika Yurichi finished, needs a sunrise.
The last airship Locke's team had stolen had been a sleek Republic military craft that Kael had, over many objections, named Eofagemet. Their current airship had been stolen from a minor lord's second-best shed several weeks ago outside Rosselefjör, after they'd finally gotten the information they needed about the Forge of the Ancients. The airship had no flame cannons, minimal barriers, and a top speed roughly equivalent to a brisk walk. The morning after their escape, from whatever the agents of the Ancients had brought to hunt them, Locke and the others were sitting in the unnamed airship when Kael sighed, banged the console, and said, "We're gonna need to put in for repairs." Locke nodded, running a finger down the length of her new dragon-headed cane sword. She'd kept it stashed back in the little town, given that dragon-headed cane swords with rubies for eyes tended to be memorable in the minds of potential witnesses later. Desidora, progress with the tracking crystal. Desidora shut her eyes and paled briefly. The wood of the deck around her went black, with the little knots taking the shape of tiny silver skulls.
It's no longer moving. At a guess, they're at their destination.
Locke grimaced.
Kael.
It's a need, not a want.
Wards are. There's something in how they're tweaked that is probably not bad until it suddenly is.
Airship wards have multiple redundant power cycles based on prime numerical values, Hessler chimed in. And the more ward crystals fail, the fewer multiples are active to keep wards constantly available. Eventually, for example, if you're down to a 7-second ward and a 13-second ward, then every 91 seconds, both will be...
While your intent is clearly to provide information, I am only becoming more alarmed, said Icy,
who was seated on the deck in an uncomfortable-looking, twisted-up meditation pose.
Yes,
Tern added from the railing, where she was determinedly not throwing up.
So we need to stop, Locke said to Kael. Well, not 91 seconds, Kale said, glaring at Hessler. But, yeah, even if we didn't have your problem with wind demons deciding they wanted to kill you, there's a small chance that a bird will fly into the balloon right when Hessler's bad thing is happening.
Right. Locke got to her feet and spun the cane sword thoughtfully. Kale, find us a salvage yard. Desidora, if the crystal is stopped, get us a location. Ululenia?
Yes, little one, came a voice in Locke's head from a spot off in the distance where a white falcon circled lazily.
Please make sure no birds hit this tub at 91 seconds.
Hessler cleared his throat.
It was an example.
She knows, baby, Tern said reassuringly.